This is Maria Rizaris presenting New Voices, a program which interviews brand new writers from all walks of life, deep in the throes of their writing projects. I will interview them, get them to read a sample of their work, then get a total stranger to critique them. Welcome to Season 2 of New Voices, and be prepared for an episode stacked with surprises. Of course, the main topic is writing, and what a writer we have. Young Lara Harriman, who at 23 is our youngest writer so far. She's a comms graduate and writes like a dream, plunging us into her soft science fiction young adult novel. Think supernatural powers, mystery murders, and a heroic police duo patrolling the night. And she is critiqued by Stephen O'Doherty, who's had a stellar career in journalism, and you could consider him to be a true polymath. He's an ex-ABC journalist and MP, is a director of an orchestra, and the chair of no less than three radio station boards. Plus, he heads a Christian Media and Arts Association. He sees the creativity in being a leader. It's about conjuring a vision, he says, just like a creative writer conjures a world for a listener and reader. As it turns out, Stephen and Lara, complete strangers, had another thing in common, a lifelong struggle with severe depression. But it's a struggle where creativity seems to have won over. Lara goes so far as to say it gives her an edge as a writer, allows her to see the world and people in a different way. Stephen heartily agrees. They certainly have learnt to tame that beast. Well, not only tame it, integrate it. Not only integrate it, they let it roar in their efforts to express themselves. Inspiring is a pretty small word. I warn listeners that there is a shameless abuse of the TARDIS as a metaphoric device. So step this way into this innocent-looking phone booth, my friend, and should you find yourself in a surprisingly large space, twinkling with panels and glowing lights and strange whooshing noises, strap yourselves in. Stephen O'Doherty and Lara Harriman will set the coordinates. Welcome, Lara Harriman. Well, your name, Lara. Were your parents romantic? Were they thinking Dr. Zhivago?
I know my mum has always said, you've got this theme called Lara's theme.
So you only joined our writers group late in the piece. I think this is the first time we've met in person.
I've only seen you on a little computer screen.
You know, you're writing really seamlessly for such a young person, because you're what?
Yeah. So I'm 23.
And that level of sophistication in your writing.
Thank
well
you.
Done. Also, you're writing
soft science fiction.
Soft science fiction.
Well, there are some strange supernatural things happening. Serious murders and strange powers. And
what you seem to be writing is young adult. Is that the category?
I'd say so. I aim towards that sort of age group as I fit more into that age group. Youngish protagonist, she's in her early 20s. Relating to that sense of identity that you're trying to build around that age, trying to build your career and trying to get a sense of who you are.
Are you from Sydney?
No, I just come from a single parent family. Grew up in a small little house in Canberra, and then when I was 12, we moved up to the Central Coast, there until a couple of years ago.
That's a very big move.
I found it very hard at the time. You're sort of losing all your friends, and no one wanted to hear about Canberra. They all hated Canberra.
Surprise, surprise.
I think more challenging moving into Sydney too. That was difficult. I moved into this share house in Strathfield, and I was just in a room with, you know, seven other people or something, and we had one tiny fridge.
You go to uni?
I've done a communications degree, but my major was creative writing. Well, I'm going to do honours this year, so I'm excited for that. Yeah. Before that, I did a year at an acting filmmaking school. I always wanted to be an author. I honestly think what probably pushed me more into writing was from a TV show, and it's probably why I like writing sort of science fiction-y type things. When I was a kid, I was pretty unhappy at school because I got bullied a lot, and I didn't really fit in. I started watching Doctor Who, which you probably know, it's a British show. My mum gave my brother this book about how the show's written, and I read it cover to cover. I got obsessed. I went, I want to be writing, I want to be creating characters. I sort of recognized that there's this intrinsic value to being able to escape, be able to live through their eyes for even just a moment. And I know when I was a kid, it gave me a lot of hope watching shows and reading books that I could relate to. Yeah. I mean, I loved in Doctor Who that there was this character, Rose, who was from a single parent family like I was. They sort of got me through, I think, a lot of hardship.
Yes.
Was being able to connect to these stories.
I think everyone who loves creative story making, you know, solace. Yeah. And as you say, the hope and brightness that this other world brings. There is light and dark in everybody's lives and you're not on your own.
I think it showed me that the humanity is very flawed, but it's beautifully flawed. You get to know someone and they're not just bad, they're not just good, but they have these interesting, complex people. Mm. And I being able to capture that in stories.
So where did the flip happen? Because not every person who reads writes.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think at school I had this teacher and he loved my writing and he said, oh, Lara, you've got to keep doing your writing. You're so talented, and made me sort of think, I really want to get better at this and I want to hone the craft and I want to be able to write the same way as the works I'm able to read. And
do you get the same amount of solace and escape in writing as you do in reading?
Yes. I think it really depends on my mindset. Sometimes writing can be really hard and you feel like you're banging your head against a wall trying to make something work.
Yes.
I guess it's different in a sense that it's exciting when I'm writing something and I'm like, yes, I know what I'm going to do now, and I'm putting together the words. If you're looking back over your work and you see a messy sentence and you're able to flesh it out and make it perfect, then it's really satisfying. But then there is that sense that when you get to write a character and you get to put little bits of, say, your experience or experiences you see around you, it feels like you're giving voice to a part of you that maybe you don't get to express or talk to other people.
You know, there are a lot of writers of all ages who think, is a course the best way?
I don't think you have to do a course to be a writer. I agree with people who say that you can hone your craft through other means, going to writing groups, practice, reading. I mean, practice is the most important. Just practice, practice.
What is it that gives you the impulse? Is it the idea that you'll be writing something like the experience that was provided for you? Or is it just the creative kind of, I've got to say this?
Yeah, I guess it's a combination. I mean, you do get that creative catharsis at times. I think for me, one of the big reasons I love writing is I feel like I'm able to articulate in writing better than I am in real life.
Ah.
On paper, you can be your true self. Maybe it's because I have been told I have a few traits of autism, and I've always been a bit on the outer at school and I never fitted in, and writing removes all of those expectations. You're often just skimming the surface. You see someone, you say, how are you? And they say, I'm good. Whereas on paper, you can be angry, you can be passionate, you can be insightful, and you can do that through a character, your voice. It frees you in a way. In real life, I'm constrained, but in writing, I get to be this person I want to be.
Yeah. You were saying to me that you've been battling depression.
I've had depression and anxiety for a decade now.
I would never guess in a million years.
People with depression get really good at hiding it. In some ways, it's really good when people don't know, because they treat you
normally. Yeah.
The downside, I suppose, is when you're feeling really down, you feel suffocated by the
normalcy
of other people.
Yeah. You've got to excuse my ignorance.
I've
got the opposite problem. I don't know what it is. It's a condition in itself. Does the writing help?
It gives you an escape. It gives you somewhere to put your emotions. In that way, depression can be a good thing, because it gives you this interesting perspective on the world.
Tell me a little bit about your story now.
Evie is the main character, and her friend Robbie, he's sort of her police partner, and they go out on patrol together. He plays an important role in the story as well, confidant for Evie. He's a bubbly, outgoing, probably more like me than
almost like Sherlock and Watson, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You kind of get to see her through the eyes of Robbie, and she sort of has a crush on her in a way.
That's pretty evident.
Yeah.
What is the name?
It's called Antiqua Mysteria, which is ancient secrets in Latin.
Oh.
This is right at the beginning. Okay. 11:47 p.m., September 21st, Gertrude Avenue, Avalon. Robbie swore as the unusually frigid September air burst through the crack in the glass door and tore at his thin denim jacket. Oh, if only he could reach back in time and throttle his past self for not picking out some warmer clothes. He could already feel the chill creeping into his collar, sending an icy shiver down his back. Then, remembering he had company, he shouldered open the door, swung his arms towards the street like a well-trained footman, and let the little brunette out. "Madame," he got a tired smile in response. "You make me feel like I'm 80, Evie told him as she brushed past, stuffing her purse under her armpit and her gloved hands into her coat pockets as she did so. "Is this compensation for you parking in the wrong suburb?" The blind on the door rattled as it swung shut behind him. He threw his backpack over one shoulder and ambled down the street, not waiting for the smaller woman to catch up. "Ah, well, who doesn't like a bit of exercise?" he called back at her. Robbie didn't really need to yell, but he loved the freedom of the empty streets at night, the thrill of holding court over a vast place, and hearing his voice carry like a rumble through the air uninterrupted. Imagining it travelling into dark and lonely crevices, into the back alleyways, and the empty cafe pergolas with their red and white stripes, rustling the pots of periwinkles on the windowsills. He suspected it was thanks to his dad, who had used to love hiking. Out in the blustering wilderness of the Scottish Highlands, the grass long enough to dance against his legs, or along green-hemmed cliffs in Wales, where you could yell and the world would yell back. "It's freezing," her voice was quieter, as if it was floating in on the wind, slipping past his ear, a lullaby. He tried to imagine her on one of those cliffs, looking out over the grey sea, her black hair flapping in her face. Would she yell at the sky too? Definitely not. She'd probably be as still as the rocks below, as distant and untouchable as the horizon. Evie appeared by his side, her walk a determined, military stiff tap-tap on the concrete. A silence fell, not an unpleasant one, but one that left him with nothing else to think about but his numb fingers and his chapped lips. "My nan used to say that Shiv is a ghost brushing past you, and that the wind is their breaths," Robbie said. He watched her eyes draw a line across the buildings opposite, as if searching for something out of place. God help her. 1 week in and she already had the eye of a cynical desk jockey like Linda. Only Linda had become that way from a hatred of the riffraff she had to deal with. Evie, well, he could imagine even her cries as a baby were measured. "That's interesting," she finally said, sounding anything but interested. "Oh, well." He let his own eyes wander over the familiar surroundings. Gertrude Avenue was busy at dinner time. There was plenty to do, given that the Dorothy Parton Theatre, Chamberlain Concert Hall, and Gertrude Avenue Cinema were all situated along the same strip. Robbie, himself, rarely came here outside of Friday drinks. Plays and that weren't really his thing. His worn-in mustard couch and radio were much too inviting. Now, the shows had finished, and it was just them and the flashing lights, circus lights, taunting them for not going, and the air still smelled of antipasto and pizza from a nearby Italian place, Mario, Maria and Brothers. Did Evie come here often? He wanted to ask but stopped himself, remembering her clipped responses to his previous attempts at getting to know her through small talk. "You know whose fault this is?" he finally asked. Evie turned to look at him expectantly, her eyes glazed with exhaustion but with flashing gold speckles from the lights. "Whatever bugger approved of having two streets named after Gertrude's a few blocks apart?" Her left eyebrow shot upward slightly. "Haven't you lived around here your whole life?" Evie asked, and gave him a wan smile, no teeth. She seemed to have an aversion to showing her teeth, even though he knew they were straight and white. Robbie wanted to tell her she looked so pretty, but swallowed his words. He didn't want to make it seem as a come-on, not with her having a boyfriend waiting at home. But really, how she made her black hair lie in perfect straight lines at her shoulders mystified him, as did her pristine outfits, always carefully manufactured to be fashionable while revealing little about her personality. Today it was a dark grey jacket, not much different to a business pantsuit, done up and complemented by a matching skirt, cream heels and opaque stockings, and a light pink scarf tossed over her shoulder, her one rebellion to her all-business ensemble. "You know," he said, "you don't have to dress up for drinks, not for the guys. You could come in bright pink trainers and your nightgown and no one would think twice." Evie's eyes narrowed and she opened her mouth, but then closed it again. "Of course you can," he bumbled on, feeling his cheeks burn. "I just don't want you to feel obligated, especially around that lot." She stopped walking. "You think I dress like this to impress men?" Robbie stiffened and could feel his skin flush red. Oh, no, no, of course not. Good, because I don't. Evie started walking again, and Robbie fumbled to keep foot with her. I'm so sorry, he pleaded with her. Oh, how his mother would smack him if she could see him now. Really, I didn't mean it like that. She raised a pointed eyebrow at him and crossed her arms. Then how did you mean it? Robbie swallowed, hard. Well, you know, the men, some of them are pricks. Evie shook her head a bit, which for her was the equivalent of an exaggerated eye roll. Oh, for goodness sake, Robert. Robbie. Fine, Robbie the Bobby. I think I can handle myself around some middle-aged men with hypertension and some green-faced recruits who insist on buying me drinks. Robbie imagined Evie walloping Phillips in his lumpy red nose for his wandering gaze and concurred she was probably right. Evie was no pushover. They turned onto Brent Street, which, despite being closer to the waterfront, had been turned into a large-scale commercial strip. The air changed from a smelling of Italian to car fumes and oil. Monolithic post-World War II brutalist buildings filled the street. They were probably once civic buildings and private offices, but since then they had been converted into housing hardware and furniture stores and their offices. They looked like concrete prisons. Wedged in between these yellow-grey boxes were car washes, car repair shops, and an abandoned warehouse. As their purposeful strides slowed down, their conversation turned on to the week before, this kid who had kept them running after him all day, all the paperwork, the struggles of the morning commute, Sergeant Davis begging out of the weekend shift and leaving them with the short end of the stick. At one point, Evie reached up to brush an errant piece of hair behind her ear, and he was surprised when he saw a flash of her wrist. The black ink of a shield emblem, some kind of bird bursting out of the lines in vibrant red and gold. That's a pretty cool tattoo, he told her. I'll be honest, you didn't strike me as the type to get one. He feels her stiffen beside him and gets a whiff of her vaguely floral perfume as she quickly returns the offending gloved hand to her side. Oh, it was one of those tattoos. He figured then that she always insisted on wearing long-sleeved uniforms, even at the academy, in spite of the shirts itching horribly. In fact, she always seemed to wear long-sleeved outfits. Robbie had just assumed it was part of her prim and proper attitude, or her way of hiding her femininity from the predatory gaze of the young, eager men at the academy. He never considered it was because of a silly tattoo. No shame in a bad tattoo, he told her, tapping his right butt cheek. Her wide gaze indicated he piqued her curiosity. As prude as Evie was, she did have a nosy side. It's just that the nosy side was usually directed at the people misbehaving under her watch. Mexico, when I was 18 and drunk off my face. A flaming tortilla with nothing hotter than this in Spanish underneath. Alexandro and I have since then come to appreciate each other, despite our differences. Another slight smile. Evie looked ahead, her left hand fiddling with the hem of the sleeve of her right wrist. Then she raised the wrist to his face, and he realized she had been undoing the button to show him. Robbie stopped for a second, examining the ink under the pale milky light of the streetlight. It was beautiful. The shield was done in the finest, most delicate lines you could get. No bleeding or fading, and a phoenix was swooping out, a sprig of lavender in its mouth. A jewel-encrusted crown detailed in rich colours of purple and gold sat upon its feathered head. It looked less like a tattoo and more like a Renaissance painting, scaled down and printed on her white skin. How did it look so perfect? Wow, he said, that's amazing. You know what it means? He shook his head, though he thought he had some idea. The rumours had circulated, of course. It's the mark of the Wandelford family. If you have the name and the lineage, they give you this when you're a child. Huh, Robbie said, trying to sound surprised. Of course, he already knew she probably had old blood. The milk skin, black hair, the unusual hazel-coloured eyes that looked like large, shining opals. That's pretty cool if I do say so myself. How old were you when you got it? Evie quickly covered it up again. When I was a baby, I think. I don't remember. They use a special old technique so it stays around. I don't know the details. I just know it won't fade, unfortunately. This was as personal as Evie had been with Robbie all week, and he had the sudden urge to keep it going. So, did you grow up there, or... Mum and I moved away when I was still an infant, she said, sighing. When I was a kid, I went back to the old borough a few times on day trips. I just remember the people were... odd, that's all. I haven't been back there since I was 13 and I don't plan to. Not that you can tell that to people around here. One look and they think you're on encyclopedia on the old Ibarro. Robbie moved a little closer so he could nudge her shoulder. Well, I think it's interesting. Nothing to be ashamed of. Evie twisted her lips as if she suddenly had a sour taste in her mouth.
Beautiful. I can't wait to line you up with a critique.
Yeah, it's exciting. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it.
Stephen O'Doherty, welcome to the program.
Maria, I loved it. Wow, what a talent.
Yes.
She's absolutely amazing.
And I like the way that that story started to unspill.
I was thinking tension and release was very clear. We knew the inner life of Robbie.
Yeah.
We didn't know much about Evie's inner life. She's a mystery. But by, I'm assuming maybe that's 5 or 6 pages we heard, we were starting to find out something really interesting about Evie. Having lived, you know, grown up as a young man, I could feel Robbie's cheeks flushing.
Yes.
I could feel his sense of embarrassment or gawkishness or awkwardness.
I love the way she did that. Both of them dancing around the dynamic of relationships. It was quite visual.
Oh, yeah.
The tattoo flashes. Tattoo.
The smell of the pizza. And antipasto lingering from the... What a beautiful image that is.
I like it when writers are as skillful as Lara and they put in little pockets of information. So her eyes drawing a line over the building.
Yeah, and then there's a little allusion to a cynical desk jockey. Even her cries as a baby would have been measured.
Measured, yes. A wan smile, no teeth.
Yeah, no teeth, even though she had perfect white ones. It's a lovely world she's created. So the tension, then the release, then more tension. And music is about that too.
Oh,
a lot
of
storytelling is about that. And so is public speaking. It's about that.
Stephen, I know that you do compose music yourself.
Whatever else I've been doing in my life, I've always had that. I also play the clarinet and saxophone and so on.
You can understand during that creative process that does provide you with a kind of solace that Lara was talking about.
Oh, I related exactly to what she was saying. The difference between Lara and me, she was saying that she communicates better in the written word her true inner self.
Yeah, yeah.
I tend to be more of a speaker, critical while I'm writing, but if I speak, it just all tumbles out of my self-conscious.
Well, you've had a stellar career in journalism. You're also the chair of Hope FM. Is it the largest community radio station in Australia?
One of the two largest.
As well as chair of several other stations on the board of the Christian Media Association. So a full banquet of activities, but you started off as a journalist.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, there were two things, music and journalism. I pursued music as a community-based activity and journalism as a career. I started in commercial radio as a journalist a number of years, did some television as well, following which I was elected to the Parliament in New South Wales, a Liberal member for Ku-ring-gai and Hornsby, and served there, following which I went in to be an advocate for Christian schools.
There's so many arrows in that,
quiver. There are some common threads, the ability to communicate ideas with others, which is where we come back to writing, whether it's music or words or prose or non-fiction or be writing a speech. It's about being able to assemble your ideas and, in the case of political speaking, I suppose, or even advocacy on behalf of community groups, it's about making a persuasive argument.
Yeah.
And in order to do any of those tasks, you need to be able to reach the listener, the hearer or the reader, which means I've got to connect with you at an emotional level. In some ways, everything is about narrative.
It is. I don't know. There's some type of a deal that goes on, I think, between a reader and a writer. The writer...
That's nice.
Well, you struggle to try and find that voice that feels true to you. That's exactly what is that the reader wants. They want to hear a true voice because that true voice then speaks to their true selves.
If I was talking to Lara, because she and I both, she has chronic depression. I've lived with depression for most or all of my adult. I'm treated for it and I work with it and I know how to recognise it, which means when you hit with a really dark couple of days, you know the third day will be better. So
you kind of
avoid some of the worst things that can happen.
Yeah, wow.
Which is what I would say to anyone listening who has that experience. But look, what I'd like to ask Lara is when she's writing, does she hear the critical voice? Because I sure do.
Right.
And it's not myself being critical of myself. There's plenty of that in the life of a depressive, you can imagine. The critical voice I hear is the critic, not the critique, the person who'll read it and say, what a load of rubbish you're talking.
Yeah, yeah.
And Lara has overcome that. She's confident enough to make her personality shine through or in the characters that she's portrayed.
What I got a sense of with Lara is that this was her escape bubble. I was asking her, does it help? And she said, sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't.
I think that's an experience I would share. So music is the thing I'll write most often from a creative aspect these days. If I'm writing words, it's a prose, it's an argument, right. It's whatever. If I'm writing music, you go into a place where you can't get out without going through it.
Yes.
You have to get to the other side. And in the middle of that, it's really quite muddy.
Yeah.
And in fact, the world gets closed off. So you've got the music running around inside your head. Yeah. And it's pushing out every other sound. Yeah. It's all you can hear.
We see, this is what she talks about with writing. Exactly what you're experiencing with music. It's like so much an expression of her that is bursting to get out. You know, I hear a lot of writers.
Maria, isn't it a privilege to be able to speak to people about their inner creative?
Absolutely.
And it's like Lara said the same thing. You know, you see people in the street, how are you? I'm fine. I want to go the extra mile. The boys always used to complain, and my wife, we'd go shopping. And I'd stand at the where you pick up the trolley, and they'd get me at the end when they'd finished, because I'd be, oh, how are you? How's your mum? What's going on? And, you know,
there's no such thing as a short shopping trip with
Stephen. With me, no. They literally say to me, you've got the words talk to me written on your forehead. I just want to relate to them. I want to find that spot. Lara talked about the same thing.
Yeah, about the layers.
And bless her for doing that, because, well, I'll let you in on a secret. Yeah. If I'm not having a great day and somebody in the shopping centre stops me and says, hi, how are you going? I saw you the other night on the drum or whatever it was, you know. Mm-hmm. Are you going well today? Sometimes I burst into tears when I get to the car because someone has seen me. Not just the me that people might know publicly, but they've seen me.
It's the witnessing, isn't it, of layers of who you are. You know, you've got your Christian faith as well.
Being a publicly professing Christian has its moments in our society, as you know. And sometimes those people in the shopping centre don't always want to say, I agreed with you on the drum. Sometimes they want to say other things based on who they think you are.
Yeah.
Bring all the baggage of the historical Christian church and I've got to say, and its failings.
Yeah. You're a man of words, the whole craft of words. You started right from the beginning.
Always a speaker. I don't remember learning to read, I just could read. So I was sort of accelerated through school, so all of those sorts of things.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. That would have made you popular with the other boys.
Not really.
No. I would imagine. So the whole bullying thing that Lara goes...
Very much.
Yeah. You can
and also being a musician and also not being athletic. And I became a journalist very quickly. I did a communications degree, just as Lara did.
Yeah. So did you ever try creative writing?
Some. I found it hard.
It's a different type of scaffolding, isn't it?
I like to think there's creativity in the way that I do other things. So I've actually learned to harness the creative process in leading boards, for instance.
Yes.
I chair three boards at the moment. Yeah. And I like to think of the creativity involved, there's plenty of it, in conducting.
Yes.
And I was mentoring a young friend of mine. 2 days ago, I said to him, you know, when you're a leader, it's not about having authority and telling people what to do. Leadership is about saying, I can visualize a better place. And if you come with me, we'll go there together.
Yes.
It'll smell like this. It'll feel like that. Literally leading people to something that sometimes they can't see.
It is very creative.
Therefore, it's creative.
Yeah. And that is exactly what Lara's doing. She's saying,
it is.
I love this world.
Yes. She did say humanity is beautifully flawed.
Oh, isn't that gorgeous?
I can't wait till I read the rest of it. I can see it, though, as a Netflix miniseries.
Yes. She learnt storytelling through television.
Well, Doctor Who, of all things.
Doctor Who. And you, like taking your board on a journey, fantastic.
Yes, hop in the TARDIS with you.
You've got your TARDIS. And she's saying, this is my TARDIS. And she's taking us along for the ride, just like you do with your board. Apparently.
Take them along for a ride.
I mean that in such a nice way.
Well, this is a visual era we're in now. If watching Netflix can make people go back and read more, then that would be a good outcome.
Because I'm hearing that from people who are hearing audiobooks, who are not really your traditional readers.
Well, I take my hat off to 2RPH for doing what it's doing with the audiobooks. I think that's a wonderful new venture for you.
Yeah, thank you.
Here we go. Here's the vision. Think of all the people who will finish the book and say thank you. They won't know your name, but they'll say thank you, 2RPH. Thank you, Maria.
Look, thank you, Stephen O'Doherty.
Been a buzz.
And I know that Lara's going to be thrilled.
I hope so.
Oh, she will. This is Maria Rosaris, and it was a pleasure to bring you this program. Produced in the Sydney studios of 2RPH, I look forward to your company next time.